on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening to the remarkable story of Frank Kravitz today. Thanks to the staff of the VA Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for allowing me to record this chat with Frank as he recovered there from some recent injuries. He survived a lot worse than that, as we're going to explore further now. We know this B-17 tail gunner was shot down on just his sixth mission, November 2nd, 1944. But we haven't heard how he safely exited a crippled bomber that had lost three of its four engines. And you were hit, Frank. That fire from a German fighter plane had left you pretty severely wounded. And you were pretty much incapacitated, weren't you?
Well, my radio operator and another fella both have me laying on the floor. And they put sulfa powder on my wound, bandaged it, and put a big compress on it. Did stop the bleeding, you know.
And this is your left thigh, and you still have shrapnel in that left thigh, right?
Over 100 pieces.
I bet you're fun to go through a metal detector with.
No, it was an interesting story, too. My wife and I took them to some of her relatives that moved to California, so we took a trip to California. So I took my wife and three kids on a plane ride to California. We get off at LAX airport, and I let the children go through, and I let my wife go through, then I go through. As soon as I passed, the thing, bells went off and horns were blowing and everything else, you know. And my family's waiting for us to greet them, you know. Two guys grabbed me by the arm. Would you step back and go through again? So I stepped back and I went through again. Now they really grabbed me and took me off to the side, you know. I says, what are you doing? What's wrong with me, you know? And my cousins out there, put them in jail. Put them, just, they were stupid, you know. So, we laugh about it all the time. Yeah. But they took me to a little room, and they asked me to strip and everything else, you know. Yeah. I says, what are you looking for? I says, I don't have no pistols or guns or nothing, you know. You know, he says, well, you're ticking off the thing. I says, how about the shrapnel in my legs? So I says, I'll drop my legs here. I got over 100 pieces in my legs. So they put the thing up there, and that's what it was. Uh-huh. Yeah, but now things are more sophisticated.
I'm sure your kids remembered that, too.
It's that time when I come to them with their dad.
Well, you dealt with much worse interrogations than that, I know, too. And I want people to understand what the situation is here. So you're on this airplane that is barely making it, that is not going to make it. And there's a real chance you aren't going to make it. You're wounded severely. You can't get yourself out of this plane. So you needed your fellow crew members to save your life, right?
After they dragged me through from the tail of the ship into the radio room, which was like a cabinet, you know, so that they could talk. And you didn't have the noise in here in the radio room, you know. So when I was on the floor, they looked at my wound and everything, put sulfa powder on it, made compresses on it, you know, wrapped it real tight and gave me morphine and other sedatives. It was in the first aid kit, you know. And I was awake.
What was going through your head?
I had no idea. I don't. The thing is, things were happening, and I'd say to myself, all I was doing there was trying to remember what's going on, unconsciously, yeah. You know, observing everything that's going on. And that's why I have such a vivid picture of it. What's ahead, I don't know. It's just happening there, you're looking at it. And I remember it, you know.
So you couldn't walk, you couldn't bail out yourself, and the captain's given the order to bail out, right?
Yeah, the captain gave the order to bail out, and they took care of me first. And they got me over to the door, put the chute on me, popped the chute in the floor, and put it in my arms and tossed me out. I just didn't take long for the chute to open up, you know. Quite a jolt, by the way.
Well, yeah, so they actually pulled the ripcord before they pushed you out of the plane. So then it's opening immediately when you pop out of that plane.
Yeah, it was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. I guess my mind was just recording it, that's all.
So you had a pretty long way down to the ground. Were you conscious? Were you looking around you? What did you see?
At first, I thought I was going up. You know, and honest to God, I thought, geez, this thing's going up, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ground started coming up to me, meet me, you know. And then there were dwellings around the area, and there was farms and everything else. So I remember that, you know. And then after I landed, I know where it was, you know. And I have one member of my crew that went over later, many years later, and he documented where our plane went down. Then when we had reunions, I had another fellow brought his video camera, and they all talked around, and we have a video of that, you know.
While all this was going on, did the thought enter your mind that you might not wake up another day, that this might be it for you?
No. I didn't think about death then, you know. I just was observing what's happening at now. That was the only thing I was interested in.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
I tumbled like a jackrabbit. I tumbled down the hill.
Yeah.
A few steps like that, because it was on a little hill like this, and I just boom, 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 boom. You know. I know their instructions were to hold your feet up and as like you got, but easier said than done, you know, especially if you're wounded, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think of that, you know.
Well, and I've talked to some POWs who tried to hide or avoid capture. Most of them, you know, maybe they lasted a few hours, but they were eventually captured. And in your case, there wasn't much you could do because you couldn't move unless you dragged yourself with your arms, huh?
Yeah. I had no motion at all. I had to be on a stretcher or a bed somewhere, and that was it, you know.
Who found you? What did they say to you?
There were two German members of the Wehrmacht, like sad sacks. You know, not very neatly dressed, or, you know, they were doing a job, that's all they were doing.
But there was another situation here where somebody saved your life because there were some civilians you'd been bombing that wanted to take your life, right?
The civilians were coming in a distance, and they came close enough that I saw they had pitchforks and that in their hands, and that, and the Germans fired a couple rounds, and they went back to where that house was at. They eventually took me anyway, you know. Took me to the farmhouse where the Hitler Youth took me, you know.
So that night, you spent the night in a cow barn, unable to move, guarded by two members of the Hitler Jugend. I can't imagine what that felt like. And even after they got you to a hospital, you don't know how much they really want to take care of you. You don't speak their language. And there was a real fear that you might lose your leg.
Well, I said when I lay was on the table, and the flying nun that was just attending to the doctor, at the thing in the table wasn't more than 3 feet wide and about belly high, you know, where I was laying on, maybe chest high or right here. And none was looking straight at my face, you know. I don't know what the procedure was, but I know they put a container on my nose and told me to count. And I remember counting to about 100.
You wanted to know if they were going to cut off your legs, so you motioned?
The nun was beside me, and I made motions with my hand if they were going to amputate. And the nun says, nine. I already knew because my mother spoke German, so different words that I didn't know from that, you know. And I just had no thoughts more, but somebody's taking care of me. Do with me what thou wilt.
But when you came to after that operation, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I took my hand, started my hip, and went down the side and see if I still had a leg. Because I thought the Germans were historically, amputations were the easiest way out. So that's what had happened. And I went down my leg and it's like that. And they patched me up the best they could. And I don't know what the drugs they used on me or anything else. But they comforted me enough that a couple of days later I was taken on a train to the interrogation center in Dulag Luft were for downed flyers.
So they didn't amputate, they took care of you. So here you have a situation. A, the civilians basically have a lynch mob and they want to take you out, and these German guards shoot their gun in the air to save your life. And then these medical professionals save your leg and get you fixed up. Looking back now, how does that make you feel to know that these people on the other side of the war, your enemies, took such good care of you?
Well, I think later finding out that because we had been taking care of downed German flyers, bringing them to the United States and taking care of them, they know what they got in the United States, German flyers here in the country, what good service they were getting. You know, I think that reflected back to us, where we didn't get treated as miserable. What do you call it, camaraderie between flyers?
Yeah.
You know. So that's what prevailed.
So you spent a lot of time just healing up, but then you still had to spend time in a couple different prisoner of war camps. I know you were about 175 pounds or so when you went into the service.
When I signed up, I weighed 175 pounds. I had to be 170 to get into the Air Force. So I went back to my football coach went down to the football field and I worked out with a football team, you know, all during the summer with him. My stepmother's angry at me because I'm not eating. I don't want to eat. I just went on a diet and I was determined I'm going to get in the Air Force and I'm going to lose this weight and I'm going to get in. So I did, you know.
A little more than a year after you were losing weight to get in the service, you were starting to lose weight, not by choice, because as a prisoner, you just didn't have much food. What was the worst of that? What was the hardest thing to deal with that element of your captivity?
Well, example to that is, I'll put it this way. One day, I was out there. They put me in an upper bunk because I'm not going to be ambulatory for a long time. They brought another down flyer in a bed next to me. We had our pleasantries, and he was in bad shape and everything else, you know. But we brought our food out. It was meager as it was, you know. I ate it, you know. And he's screaming, "I can't eat this crap," you know. I says, "Well, what are you going to do with it, you know?" He says, "You want it?" I says, "Yeah, I'll take it." They passed it over to me and I ate it, you know. A couple of days of that, no more food came over. he needed it, you know, but that was a part of it. I said, give me all you got, you know. Yeah. But then after my hospital visit, they had, like I said, the food parcels that they confiscated and they used them for themselves and for us.
So the Red Cross would send parcels, but it didn't all make it to you guys, the prisoners.
They did meagerly. In fact, every parcel that they brought to the hospital, they punctured it. So if you had meat and beans in there, boom, you had to eat it within a couple of days, you know. So the idea was to hoard those things that you're going to last longer, sugar, coffee, chocolate bars. You start eating small pieces of it, you know.
And you would make use of the packaging. Some of that stuff came in, too. I know in your book you have a picture, a replica of the stove that you improvised. Tell us about that stove.
The history of the stove is the British were longer in the war than we were. They were real troopers, and they're the ones that designed various different designs of, call them Krieg stove, K-R-E-I-G for Kriegsgefangen, you know. So we called them Krieg stoves. So when I was in marching on the road and had this other thing, I just stuck in my mind because other people had them, you know. Years later, when I came home, you know, I said, I'm going to make one of them things. And I did.
So tell us what it's made out of, because I don't think many people would think to make a stove out of the elements that you had to work with.
Well, first of all, with a stove, you have to have a furnace with something that's going to hold the flame of whatever you're going to use to boil if it's water, you know. And so you had a can underneath that held the chips of wood that just scrounged around from somewhere. Some guys went out to work and they brought in trees in their pockets and that. And there was some kind of a supply that you could have in a barracks that somebody always had. And they made these stoves, and with the forced air that they had, it didn't take as much time. Little blast furnace, you know, and a small quantity, you know, to make a cup of tea. And once they got this thing on, get your can ready, put it on there, and then next guy's on there, next guy's on there, just stuff like that. So that's how that worked.
So you made it out of Klim cans that had come in the Red Cross parcels.
Klim cans, and then there were other cans, flattened them out with a wooden mallet and made the wheel, or the lids with our coffee came in. They put two lids together to make the wheel.
Did you ever eat the infamous bread made out of mostly sawdust?
Did I? I sure did. In fact, if you give me your address, I'm going to send you, it was in our POW magazine, a copy of the ingredients.
The recipe, let me guess, there's a lot of tree flour, right?
Yeah. In fact, they use the outer bark, it seems like.
You didn't mind because it was something to eat?
Well, absolutely.
Did you ever think of escaping?
No, I don't think I ever did. With that many people, you know, guns are there, they're going to open fire on you. But first of all, there was a 10-foot warning wire inside and a 20-foot wire outside and barbed wire in that empty space. Now, many of the guys lost their life by trying to get through that maze because they got fired on right away anyway. And then the tunnel bit and everything else. I didn't see any of that kind of stuff, but it's historically, they did dig tunnels.
And how much did you weigh when you were liberated?
118 pounds.
So all these months, you're wasting away. You don't have enough to eat. You don't know when the war is going to be over or that your side's going to win. What gave you hope? Where did that come from? How did you believe that there was still a life out there for you?
I believed in the good Lord would take care of me. It's all whatever becomes of me. Never thought you were going to die, or for that matter, you know. You're living, so you live. And who knows when you're going to die anyway, you know.
And all this time, your family had no idea what would happen to you?
No.
In Frank's book, 11-2, there's a photo of the telegram his family received reporting him missing in action. Also a newspaper clipping from when it was learned he was in a prisoner of war camp. I got the link to his book posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear the rest of Frank Kravitz's story when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.